Everybody is welcome. We don't care where you come from.
Celebrating diversity. This is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
You can count on us to put Bristol music first.
Party with girls that do it all.
That's how we do it.
We done push the boys. That's how we roll. Yeah. That's how we roll. Yeah. That's how we roll. Yeah.
We done. If we give you an order to assassinate someone, will you carry out that order with no reservations and no hesitation? And he said, no. They said, you can't be a member of U.S. Army Special Forces. Put him out the door, and he was recruited by the Central Intelligence Agency on the same day.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Tonight we ask the question nobody in the London media has thought to ask. Is Ebola natural or is it man-made? AIDS and Ebola are relatively new diseases, unknown before the 1980s. If they're so dangerous, why didn't they ravage mankind before that? They just appear naturally out of the blue, or are they results of biogenetic research that escaped into the environment? Or could Ebola be part of a 1962 US biological weapons research program designed to create new viruses which would first attack the immune system and then, 9 times out of 10, kill the patient? So are we also being told the truth about how Ebola is transmitted? Also, one of the top Mexican drug cartel leaders was arrested this week after allegedly ordering the massacre of 50 young left-wing student campaigners who were on their way to Mexico City as part of a national social justice campaign. That's what it takes for the government to act in Mexico. But what does it take here for our government to act against HSBC Bank, which looked after the cartel's billions of pounds? They even adapted their HSBC banks over in Mexico to take suitcases full of cash. And according to the whistleblower Edward Stern, they're still merrily laundering drug money after being fined a few days' profits. And no HSBC staff being jailed or prosecuted. Well, we speak to HSBC whistleblower Nicholas Wilson. And Nicholas, I hope, is joining us on the phone. Nicholas, first of all, tell us about the links between this firm you worked for and HSBC.
Well, yeah, I worked for a firm of solicitors called Waitmans, and I'd acted for the John Lewis Partnership for about 20 years. There's a big one in Bristol, the Cribbs Causeway, isn't there? And in 2003... HSC Bank bought the John Lewis accounts package, you know, the store accounts. And at the same time, the same year, HSBC bought HFC. So basically, I was then acting for HSBC. And we handled the John Lewis debts. But as soon as the bank started handling John Lewis debts, they started adding illegal charges onto the debts. They added 16.4%. to cover the legal costs, the solicitor's legal costs. So the bank didn't pay any legal costs at all. I estimate in total it was about £1 billion in unlawful charges were added to accounts.
Well, it's already all very well to say unlawful, but if you get one of these orders to pay the money, surely, and especially if it's come through the courts, you're going to pay it, aren't you?
No, well, it was, they put the solicitors added the charges on. As soon as the debt was passed to the solicitors added 16.4% onto the debt. There was no provision in the consumer credit agreements. There were no terms and conditions that allowed them to do that. The terms and conditions just said, we will charge you reasonable costs. Well, on a £10,000 debt, 16.4% is £1,640. And they were charging that before they'd even written the first letter. So that's not reasonable. It was also illegal because they were what's called contingency fees, which means that if the debtor couldn't, the solicitors kept 16.4% of whatever money the debtor paid. So if the debtor did a deal and they settled for £5,000, the solicitors would take 800 and odd pounds. So it was a percentage of whatever was recovered. It was contingent on the result. That's illegal in this country.
Yeah, but surely HSBC had just kind of bought this company, hadn't they? I think from the US, if I'm right.
Well,
So it wasn't really HSBC's responsibility. It was the responsibility of this company.
Well, HFC, yes, Household Finance Corporation, were originally an American bank, but they were established. They've been established in the UK since the 70s. But I told HFC at the first meeting I had with their head office, I told their solicitor, a guy called Duncan Hamilton, that the charges were illegal. I told all the senior staff at the office where I worked that the charges were illegal, and eventually I reported to my solicitors to the Solicitor Regulation Authority. But to answer your question about HSBC, the current chair of HSBC, Douglas Flint, he was the finance director for 15 years before he became chair. Now, when HSBC bought the bank, they would have done their due diligence and would have looked at HSC's accounts. They must have wondered why there was no provision in the accounts for legal costs, for delinquent debts. There was nothing. He didn't ask any questions. The HSBC, of course, always denied this. But the simple answer I would say to HSBC is, well, show me the paid invoices. Show me the solicitor's invoices that you paid for the debt recovery work.
Okay.
And they won't have any.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that surely is just an arrangement between the solicitors and this household finance firm,
yes,
isn't it?
But it's illegal.
Okay.
It's against the law, it's against the solicitors' rules, and the Solicitors Regulation Authority confirms that.
Okay, so what happens when you take the Solicitors Regulation Authority route and you find that, something that's been done wrong? What happened in your case when you reported them?
Basically, they said, yes, we agree it's a contingency fee and they breached the rules, but it only happened in a small number of cases. Well, when I left the firm, the firm sacked me immediately when I reported them, and when I left the firm, we had 70,000 to 80,000 cases worth over £100 million. And as I say, in total, there were two firms of solicitors doing this, my firm and another firm called Reston's, and in total, I estimate £1 billion was added on illegally to debts.
And what sort of debts were these?
Generally, HFC handled the accounts for John Lewis, Dixon's, Curry's, B&Q, Furniture Village, PC World, a whole load of high street stores, but they also specialised in subprime lending, which makes this even worse in a way, because subprime lending is to some of the poorest people who can't get loans from high street banks. And they had it was either HFC Bank or Beneficial Finance, which was a subsidiary of HFC, who made personal loans, limited then, I think, to 15,000, but then the limits disappeared. So some of these charges that they added on were over £5,000 for doing nothing, and people paid them.
But surely it's down to those people who've paid those, you say are illegal charges to then take Waitman's or take John Lewis or HSC to court.
Well, they don't know, do they? You see, I've been trying to get some publicity about this for a long time. I've been trying to help people recover money. I have helped some people. I went through the Financial Ombudsman and I have helped some people get money back. But the problem is I can't reach people unless I have publicity. I did try to get information from the Ministry of Justice. I tried to get county court judgment details, which are public records. They're supposed to be in the public domain, but they refused to let me have them.
So what you were trying to do is to contact people, individuals,
yep,
who have been forced to pay these illegal,
yep,
charges, just to let them know that they're illegal, and then maybe to get a class action or something like that together.
Yeah, exactly. I worked for a firm of solicitors in London, a firm called Lee Day & Co, as a consultant a couple of years ago, and we were preparing a class action against the bank. It would have been a multi-million pound action, but unfortunately that fell through because a conflict of interest arose within the business, in a conflict arose which meant that we couldn't sue the bank, so I had to leave. And I've since tried to find another firm of solicitors to do a group action, But they all bank with HSBC, or they all act for HSBC, or they didn't want to work with me because I was breaching a confidentiality agreement, which I am doing now, talking to you.
Oh, well, thank you.
but don't worry, I've been doing it for years.
But the solicitors regulation, how does that all work? Tell us what happened there, because you would expect that this is where something like this gets caught and stopped, especially if it's illegal activity.
No, that happens if it's an ethnic minority solicitor in the high street in Bristol who's doing something dodgy, they will close him down. But when it's a big national firm, they don't touch them. They go for low-hanging fruit.
So what did they do in your case then?
Well, they made this... they spent a year looking at it. Then after a year, they gave me the adjudication. They said they upheld my complaint. They said they had been acting unlawfully. But get this, Waitman's carried on doing it after the SRA adjudication. And then if you look at my website, there's an entry on there from a consumer debt, a consumer action group, which is a consumer forum on the internet. Somebody on there wrote to the SRA saying, Waitmans have put this charge on my debt. I don't think it's correct. This was after the SRA adjudication. The SRA wrote back and said, Waitmans are a properly regulated firm who abide by the rules. That was a year after they'd found against Waitmans for breaching the rules. So they're covered for them.
What's your experience been then of the way that these big financial organisations are regulated?
Well, they're not. My most recent experience, and one of the most shocking aspects to this whole thing, is the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority. They did nothing. I reported the bank to them in December 2012, and they did nothing. So earlier this year, I did a Freedom of Information Act request to the FCA, asking them what they'd done, giving me details. And eventually they wrote back and said, we didn't do anything, because in November 2010, the Office of Fair Trading made an order against the bank, which is true. I'll tell you about that in a moment. And it went on. They went on to say, but HFC's agreements allowed them to add a collection charge. Well, it's true the LFT did make an order against the bank in 2012, and the order said you must not make a collection charge until you change the terms and conditions of your agreement. So they completely contradicted the LFT order. But this gets worse. That was about April, I think. In June or July of this year, a fellow financial campaigner called Joel Benjamin, who works for an organisation called Move Your Money, he contacted HSBC and said, why haven't you investigated Mr. Wilson's complaints of fraud? They wrote back and they said, we didn't, because in November 2010, the Office of Fair Trading made an order against the bank and their agreements allowed. Two paragraphs, exactly the same wording as the FCA sent to me. Exactly the same word, copied and pasted. So the bank and the FCA are colluding together to cover up fraud, and in those statements that they gave, they both lied. And it's all on my website. You can see the OFT order, and you can see what they say.
Your website is nicholaswilson.com.
Yeah.
With a nice HSBC picture with fraud written next to it, on the side of it. This is a fascinating insight. I would imagine most people in your position would have... Nicholas would have probably have thought, well, I'm not going to blow the whistle, I'm not going to report my own firm to the solicitors regulators, because it's going to lose me my job. Do you think that there's quite a lot of people out there with knowledge of fraud that's going on today that think about their careers rather than the public interest?
Well, I'm not a career lawyer, which is why I did it. There's a lot of fraud going on in the legal profession that isn't reported, because lawyers will not want to. It will ruin your career. If you blow the whistle in the law, probably in banking too, you'll never work again. Whistleblowers have a terrible time. I haven't worked again. I've had some occasional consultancy work, but I haven't had a full-time job since I was sacked by Waitmans. It ruins your life. And the thing about lawyers is they all have a duty. They're all partners. They're partnerships, and they all have a duty to report any wrongdoing if they come across it. But they earn so much money. I mean, the equity partners at Waitmans were earning £300,000 a year. They're not going to rot the boat. You know, there are very, very few whistleblowers in the law. And I did it because I wasn't a solicitor. I'm not a qualified lawyer. So, I didn't have that to lose. Although I have just bought a house, and it was a very worrying time. Well, it's been stressful ever since.
Yeah, just tell us about the personal side of this, Nicholas, because, you know, maybe without going into too much detail, but, you know, the personal side of actually putting your career on the line, and actually this is going to affect your family too, isn't it?
I mean, it's ruined my life. I sold my house in London that I had just bought. I bought the house because I won the contract for my firm. Now, they'd never heard of HFC, and I did all the negotiating and the meetings and so on, and I won the contract. So I thought, well, my future's safe, and I bought a house. A year later, I was sacked for reporting the wrongdoing. Eventually, we went to mediation. Instead of going to tribunal, we went to mediation and settled, and they paid me a lot of money. They paid me a lot of money to keep my mouth shut, although they deny that. I mean, that's not what they paid me for. And it was only when I found out they were still doing it, after I'd reported them, that I decided to go public with it and breach the confidentiality agreement. But, yeah, it's ruined my life. I sold my house in London, moved down to Hastings to save on costs. I've been on benefits now for 2 years. I'm actually on ESA, Employment Support Allowance, because I'm too... stress and post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm in a state. It's completely ruined me. But I keep fighting because I estimate 500,000 to 600,000 people have been affected by these charges.
Now, you talked about Reston's solicitors. The boss of Reston's, Christopher Reston's, got a nice private jet, hasn't he?
Yeah, let's not libel him. I think he sold that jet, but at the time I'm talking about, he lived in Andorra, which is a tax haven, and he's got a pilot's license, and he flew his own private jet to the UK in Warrington to work at a firm with 5 solicitors who specialise in debt recovery. Now, unless he has private wealth, you might wonder how on earth he earns that kind of money.
Well, maybe it's through levying illegal charges.
I couldn't say that, because if he has got private wealth, that would be libel. But he certainly lived a very good lifestyle and he was doing this illegal work.
Now, the chairman of HSBC at the time was Stephen Green. He was lord, wasn't he?
Well, you might be interested to, because it's up your street, I think, MI5 involvement with all this. The OFT order was dated the 17th of November 2010. That's when it was signed. On the 16th of November 2010, David Cameron made Stephen Green, who was the chair of HSB, a lord, and invited him to be a trade minister. Then he was introduced to the lords on the 22nd of November. On the 22nd of November, the OFT released a press release with that order, but the press release was about charging orders, nothing to do with collection charges. And right at the bottom, there was this little PDF attachment, which was the order against HFC about their collection charges. So nobody picked it up. None of the media picked it up because it was hidden away, because they didn't want to embarrass Stephen Green and Cameron.
That's a bit annoying, isn't it? And also, I noticed that the Office of Fair Trading was closed this year.
Yeah, and it's now the FCA that deals with it. So it's going to be even worse. I mean, at least the OFT investigated them and made that order against them. The FCA just lie now. They don't want, you know, they just lie about it.
Can you see the wood for the trees at all through this?
Yeah, there is somebody...
Because, you know, it would be nice to think that at least when this is so systematic, this fraud, that some of the victims of it can at least get together, and even if it's just to cry on each other's shoulders, to do something.
Well, the problem is, Tony, it's they stopped doing it in 2010 now, and although there's no problem with limitation in legal action, the problem will be documentation. Most people won't have any paperwork anymore. But what I want to achieve is that people get their money back. Now, you know, that there'll be a lot of people who won't, because they won't be able to prove anything, but we can always get an order on the bank to produce their records to get people to have their money back. That would be resolution for me. I can say there is somebody, and I can't say too much about this, but there is somebody looking at this in a lot of detail, a very important resource, who I think are going to do a story on it, and so I'm hoping it's going to be big news in the next few weeks.
Well, I certainly hope so. But what about the sort of spiritual side of this? Because I would have thought you'd need some kind of, some kind of spiritual help, beliefs or whatever, to help you carry through, because it seems to me that you're still doggedly fighting even after you've lost so much, and you're now having to sign on, even though you had quite a nice glittering wealthy career ahead of you.
I had a good job. I wasn't never wealthy, but I had a good job. I was well paid, and I lost all that. I don't want them to get away with it. I mean, as you know, the banks crashed the economy in 20... And that was all to do with subprime lending, to do with mortgages and so on. HSBC is one of the most evil banks in the world. I've just been contacted by some people in New York about a horrific sexual harassment case at HSBC in New York. I've been contacted by some solicitors in Canada about something else. I mean, I'm now getting a reputation as somebody to go to to do with HSBC.
Well, look, can you tell us about some of those? Because when you finished... Oh, you can't.
Well, I can tell you about the sexual harassment, because that's on my website.
Fine, yeah, go for it, because we're going to be talking in a minute about the Mexican drug cartels and HSBC.
Oh, well, this is the whole HSBC culture. If you look at my website, I've got excerpts from... There's a case has been issued in a court in New York against HSBC by two people, one called James Rist and one called Peter Caparelli, I think it was. They both worked at HSBC in New York, and they both knew a woman who's being called Jane Doe. Her boss, who is a woman, who was the senior vice president of the bank, used to encourage her to wear revealing clothes, told her that she should sleep with HSB clients and senior staff to further her career, at one time pulled her blouse down to expose her breasts, and they'd go on these jollies in there was some villa somewhere that they went to, and I think it was a Mexican, HSB Mexican guy, who said to her that he wanted to push her over the table, bend her down, pull her pants down. Well, I won't go any further.
Yeah, I think we should leave it there, yeah.
Yeah, but these two guys, they reported all this to HR department, and it's called illegal retaliation in the States. So they've issued proceedings, they've damaged their careers, they got sacked and demoted. So they're suing HSBC for damages for what happened. And, you know, they said those people that work there, particularly this woman, they all work there through friends. They don't have any experience in banking previously. They just know people. It's just, I mean, it's a kind of network. And that's how those people got those jobs.
So that's fascinating. I mean, what has this taught you about the way that our financial system works, HSBC in particular?
Well, it's corrupt from top to bottom, including the... I mean, everybody knows what banks are like, but I don't think everybody knows what the regulators are like. And I'm actually more angry with the regulators and MPs. The whole of the Treasury Select Committee on Banking Standards, I have emailed all of them a number of times, as has Ian Fraser, who's a very respected financial journalist in Scotland. He's just written a book about RBS. He has written to them a talk as well about my case.
Well, we should plug Ian's book, I think. Excellent book it is, too, called Shredded.
Shredded, yeah, it is excellent, yeah. Well, he's a big supporter of me. He has said, and I quote this on my Twitter account, of all the whistleblowers I've met, Nicholas Wilson has about the most credibility and is the least motivated by personal grievance. And he has written to the Parliamentary Commission on Banking Standards, so about 10 MPs. They ignore him. They ignore me. In fact, the only response I got, I sent an email with 10 recipients or so, the only response I got was from one MP, Jesse Norman, who said to me, "How did you get my personal email address?" Here am I reporting £1 billion fraud by Europe's biggest bank. All he cared about was me having his email address.
Okay.
That's what politicians are like.
Well, I don't think they're all like that.
Well, no, all right. But nobody helped me.
there's also, I think, a lot of influence of the city, between the city and politics. Can you just tell us what you make of that? I mean, certainly the way I see it, most of the main political parties, you can only progress in them if you're really just following the policies of the City of London.
Well, yeah. The City of London, as you know, is the world, and it's the world's biggest money laundering centre. And certainly the Tories, the majority, over 50% of their funding comes from the City of London. City of London spend millions of pounds lobbying, which is why George Osborne is fighting Europe to get the bankers' bonuses cap removed. So yes, there's a symbiosis. I mean, basically the banks own the politicians and the media. That they basically own the world.
They don't own us.
But they own you, and thankfully
yet.
And, well, did you see my article on RT as well? I mean, there are some brave journalists who will go with this, and you're the first one actually is interviewing me in this way. BBC run a mile, but then, as you probably know, the BBC have just appointed an HSBC director to be the chair of the trustees.
Yeah, I mean, actually, that's amazing. I mean, I think her job is just to stop the BBC doing any documentaries about the HSBC.
Well, it's probably because she was, I don't know if you know this, but she was head of risk compliance, of the Committee on Risk Compliance in the United States at the time HSBC were fined $1.9 billion for money laundering. She was in charge of risk and compliance.
And now
she sat on the committee. I shouldn't say in charge. She sat on the committee.
It's a bit galling, isn't it, when what happens is you get a reward for criminality to become chairman of the BBC.
Yeah, I don't know about her, but Stephen Green should be in prison. And I think Douglas Flint should be in prison, and I think my employers and the people at Reston should be in prison.
Can you just, those two, Stephen Green and Douglas Flint, why do you think, you know, one by one they should be in jail?
Well, Stephen Green... Well, partly because of the Mexican thing. I mean, I've been told if he set foot in the States, he'd be arrested on sight, or certainly at that time. You know that the $1.9 billion fine was a payoff, and they got a deferred prosecution agreement.
Yeah, it was an out-of-court settlement.
An out-of-court settlement, but they're on probation for 5 years, and if they do anything naughty in the following 5 years, they'll lose their licence in the States.
Well, as we've heard, we're going to hear in a little while from Edward Stern, he says they're still doing it.
You're talking to him in the States?
No, he's we've got just a bit of info from him from last year. You know, so he says HSBC are still doing money laundering.
Yeah, I'm following him. He follows me, and we're, you know, following each other on Twitter, and I keep up with him. Well, I can't comment on that because I don't know. But Douglas Flint was the finance director for 15 years. So, you know, in terms of my story, he must have known what was going on. Oh, interestingly, the solicitor at HFC Bank, the one I told what they were doing was illegal, I reported him to the SRA in 2012 as well. Shortly after that, he mysteriously left HSBC, and he's now working as a consultant at Reston's. Now, I think what happened, and let's give HSBC a break. Let's just say they didn't know it was going on, but my report and my reporting him to the SRA alerted them to a problem, and they got rid of him. I think that's what happened. But they still won't put their hands up. What HSBC should do is say, we didn't know about this, we're really sorry about it, we will pay everybody back.
Yes, but that's going to be expensive.
Yeah, it'll cost them.
I mean, they can actually make money up out of nowhere and lend it at interest.
You know, it's nothing to them. A week's profit. It'll make huge difference to other people. I mean, some people have lost their homes over this, Tony. When I was working at Lee Day, I came across two cases, HFC, where they had a charging order on somebody's property, which would have included these illegal charges, and they applied to the court for an order for sale. So they forced these two people to sell their homes and recovered these illegal charges.
Okay, Nicholas Wilson, can you just remind us of your website and how people can get in touch or donate to you? Because, you know, this is actually quite a good cause you're on here. And also, I just hope that you're able, you know, in the next few months, even if you're not able to get exactly what you want, to be a place, a sort of first point of call for those with information about fraud going on at HSBC.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to remind us of your website and how people can get in touch. Is there any other way people can get in touch other than on the internet?
Twitter.
Or you've got a Twitter feed as well?
My Twitter name isn't... I'll tell you why. My Twitter name is Mr. Ethical. That's because my boss at Waitman's, when I used to complain about the contract, he said, oh, here comes Mr. Ethical. So I call myself Mr. Ethical.
Okay, Nicholas Wilson, it's been a great pleasure having you on. Power to your elbow, sir.
Thanks for having me.
And we will leave the details on our show page, which is www.thisweek.org.uk, in case you want to get in touch with Nicholas. Thanks again, Nicholas.
Thanks, Tony. Bye.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Yeah, pretty shocking story there, Martin. HSBC seems running rings around the law and actually sitting in the government in the form of Lord Green.
Well, yes, I mean, this is, I hadn't heard anything about the particular problems that Nicholas has had, but obviously we've been aware of them, money laundering and Green's involvement. I mean, it strikes me that this is very similar to the PPI selling scandal, and ultimately it could lead to a situation where they do have to pay it back, which is no doubt why they are trying to cover it up, because, you know, we've got a precedent for banks being forced to pay back you know, charges and policies that they've sold, missold, or rather fraudulently created. So, in principle, you know, if we can get enough steam behind this, we can force them to pay it back.
But what about the $1.9 billion fine that HSB had to pay? We were hearing about there. Now, how does this? Yes, apparently it's just a couple of weeks' profits or something. So this is possibly carrying on. So how do these big banks like HSBC link in with drug cartels? Because this is a very, very serious and dangerous organisation. We'll be talking in a minute about the leader of one of the Mexican drug cartels, who's just allegedly, anyway, ordered the massacre of 50 students who were on their way to Mexico City just to take part in a protest.
Well, one of the problems is that when HSBC are called to account for drug dealing or money laundering, it's the bank as an institution which is fined. Now, in actual fact, that $1.9 billion is actually just, you know, creamed off the top of the profit the bank is making. No individual is being held responsible. If Lord Green had been fined $1.5 billion, that would have been a punishment. But fining the bank,
it's $1.9 billion.
Yeah, $1.9 billion. That would have been a punishment. But of course, what you've actually got to do is individuals within the bank have to be prosecuted and sent to prison and all their assets seized. And in actual fact, if we did that, we'd actually find that we've actually got an awful lot of money to pay down deficits and debts around the world. In other words, bankrupt the banks and take the money off them and send them to prison.
What about the links between drug running and banking?
Well, they're intimate. They've been going on for years. I mean, as I mentioned in the first hour, in 2009, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime produced a report, mainly police officers who staff it, and they were absolutely clear what had happened in 2008 during the banking crisis is that all the dirty money which was hanging around waiting to be laundered all over the world was sucked into the system in one go, and without the drug cartels' money, the banking system would have collapsed. That is the reality of the world we now live in, where more money is spent on drugs and prostitution every year in Britain than is on housing. Now, that's enormous amounts of money, and it's actually underpinning the financial system. And ultimately, this is, you know, it's got to change. We've got to think about things like drug legalisation, and we've also got to create a not ethical banking, I would suggest public banking. The banking system should be basically run as a public utility, not as a private enterprise rip-off exercise.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because a lot of these institutions after the Second World War were nationalised, really basic stuff, which had been some of it for many years, things like water, electricity, transport, some really basic stuff. And what is the principle there, this kind of socialist principle of keeping these in public ownership? What's the point?
Well, so it depends what kind of structure a market has. When you've got lots and lots of small producers and lots of potential competition, it doesn't make sense for the government to run it all. So, for example, you know, you can see mobile phone companies are, you know, there's quite a lot of them you can choose. It makes sense. But, of course, in the old days, when you had basically landlines and that's all there was, it made sense for BT to be in the public sector.
But hang on a minute, because they do this thing called confusion marketing, don't they, where you have every single company does some kind of tariff which can't be compared to another company.
Well, that's true, and of course,
telecoms a basic thing that should be nationalised?
I think there's a case to be made for private, you know, to allow the private sector to operate in the modern telecommunications market. It certainly wasn't the case in the 1950s. It made no sense at all for that. Because if you've got a monopoly control, which of course when landlines all there was, the company concerns got a monopoly control.
But what when, for example,
there is no competition.
Martin,
and that's
when, for example, Vodafone spy on politicians in Greece, as they did, and then the guy that reports it, this spying, software spying on Vodafone's system on Greek politicians, is then found dead.
Well, that's because what we're talking about there is the manipulations by intelligence services and other sinister forces.
Well, maybe with the cooperation of a company.
Yes, well,
for,
all right.
For profit.
All right, well, I mean, let's not just fixate on telecommunications.
It's about openness.
We started by talking about
these
banking.
These private companies are very closed. They will use commercial confidentiality to stop anybody knowing what they're doing.
Yeah. But, I mean, I would argue that certain industries very definitely should be in the public sector. Transport, for example. I mean, what the Labour Party should do, is simply say that it's going to renationalise the railways and then dare Nigel Farage to agree with them. But they won't do it because the city controls, you know, that's thought crime
back in modern Britain. Back to HSBC in Mexico, because we hear today, I was looking on the internet last night, the Guardian's got it today, Mexico has arrested the alleged leader of the Juarez drug cartel, Vicente Carrillo Fuentes. The Guardian is saying actually Associated Press, the Guardian are just using a newswire story here. The alleged leader of the Juarez drug cartel, Vicente Carrillo Fuentes, has been arrested in the northern city of Torreon, two Mexican officials said on Thursday. Carrillo Fuentes, 51, heads the cartel founded by his late brother Armando Carrillo Fuentes, and Mexico had offered a reward of 30 million pesos, 2.2 million, for his arrest. It was the second capture of a major drug lord in as many weeks. Mexican authorities nabbed Hector Beltran Levia as he ate fish tacos in a seafood restaurant in central Mexico on the 1st of October. Two officials revealed the information about Carrillo Fuentes' arrest, insisted on speaking anonymously because they were not authorised to speak to the press. So there's a nervousness amongst the police. So two heads of drug cartels arrested. But Martin, it's taken this hideous massacre of, it looks like now, 50 young activists who are on their way to a peaceful demonstration in Mexico City to make this happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's lots of... I mean, it's a particularly horrific crime and it's got a political dimension, but, I mean, there's an awful lot of people being killed as a result of drug cartel activity. But, the drug cartels are integrated with the intelligence services. Going back to the 1980s, there's a new film coming out about Gary Webb, who was the journalist on the San Jose Mercury in the 1980s, who exposed the links between the CIA, the Contras, and the drug cartels. And at the time, he was rubbished and he supposedly committed suicide. But in actual fact, the evidence is overwhelming. The US intelligence services are in the drugs trade up to their neck. They have been for years. Alfred McCoy wrote a book about it, and so did Mike Rupert, who was an ex-police officer from Los Angeles.
This time last year, insider whistleblower Edward Stern told the Huffington Post and anyone else who would listen, he said, "Is anyone listening? HSBC continues to launder money for terrorist groups."
Yes, well, what they mean by terrorist groups is the Iranians and what have you. I mean, basically, don't forget, money's money, and banks are likely to be happy to take money from anybody. But it's not just that there's these evil cartels out there subverting the banks. Don't forget that these drug... I mean, anybody in Colombia or Mexico will tell you that the US intelligence services have their own favourite cartels. Yeah, so they use the drug enforcement against the opposition, and those which they're in favour of, they allow them to operate. And quite recently in Australia, for example, a plane was captured on the ground full of drugs, and it turned out to be a plane bought by the CIA for its activities in the 1960s. A plane crashed in Mexico a few years ago. It was full of drugs. Well, that plane was last seen on the tarmac at Glasgow Airport, involved in rendition.
Well,
the attitude of
companies like HSBC to these big legal cases in the US, nothing really happening to them here, it seems. Just seems to be, well, let's continue to do what we did, but just try and hide it a bit better.
Well, no, but the fact is, if you get fined $1.9 billion. On the basis of making $500 billion in profit, that is actually just like paying a parking ticket, and it's actually a green light to carry on, isn't it? Even if we get caught again, it'll only be another $1.9 billion, and that's nothing to us.
Okay. Also, this week, the Aphex Twin Richard D. James says he pretty much believes in the Illuminati, and he thinks September the 11th attacks were absolutely an inside job. This is in the Independent last week. Aphex Twin mastermind is a musician. Richard D. James is just not willing to accept society's theories blindly. In fact, he thinks 9/11 attacks on New York were absolutely an inside job after watching YouTube documentaries on the subject. Martin, this is a mainstream alternative, I suppose, musician. Another person coming out and saying that there's an inside job, the 9/11 attacks.
Well, I mean, as you know, I'm a founder member of Reinvestigate 9/11 in the UK, and I certainly believe it's an inside job. So do the Russian general staff. General Leonid Ivashov, who was in command of the Russian armed forces on September the 11th, 2001. He's now retired from being the head of the Russian armed forces, but he's quite clearly, very calmly, on the internet, on his web pages and elsewhere, pointing out that we know who did 9/11. It was an inside job by the Israelis and the CIA.
Okay, so now we go on to have a look at the Ebola crisis. As I mentioned at the top of the hour, AIDS and Ebola are relatively new diseases, unknown before the 1980s. If they're so dangerous, why didn't they ravage mankind before that? Martin, what are your thoughts about this week? I mean, I can tell you, for one thing, nobody seems to believe that the government's new measures, apparently they've said yesterday that they're going to be at airports checking anybody that's come from West Africa and asking them questions, this sort of thing. But nobody, none of the professionals seem to think that it's going to make any difference whatsoever.
Well, look, I'm not an expert in things like epidemiology, if that's what you call it. I remember the swine. Do you remember the SARS and swine flu scares that we had a few years ago? I mean, a lot of that was being hyped by vaccine companies. I'm afraid that the World Health Organization and various other organizations that are supposedly giving us independent advice about Ebola and other things have a vested interest in selling various pharmaceutical solutions to the problems that are being identified. I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't know where Ebola came from. We could discuss that in a moment. There clearly is some kind of a problem. But, of course, it's very difficult to disentangle what's really happening from panic, fear and vested interest to in creating panic and fear.
Professor George Griffin, chair of the government's advisory committee on dangerous pathogens, said that most of the scientific community felt that a screening was a very, very blunt instrument. Apparently, there is really no way to effectively screen this because people are coming in from all different parts of the world. The place to do it has got to be as people get on planes leaving that part of the world, apparently. And what I was hearing on 5 Live yesterday, there's only 3 destinations that people fly to from there: Paris, Brussels and Casablanca. So that's where the action needs to be.
Well, maybe, yeah. But it's going to be very difficult. I mean, obviously, air travel does make the possibility of this transporting very rapidly from one side of the world to the other. And, of course, on aeroplanes, of course, the air is recirculated inside the aeroplane. So if you've got somebody with a virus on the plane, everybody on the plane potentially is breathing in the virus. So it's a very, very effective vector for spreading disease, isn't it?
Well, this story reminds me of a fascinating book from a couple of decades ago now, called Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola: Nature, Accident or Intentional. These are by Dr. Leonard Horowitz, and he's been going for years on this subject, saying that he has actually discovered US biological weapons programs behind these two particular diseases.
Well, I've certainly been reading that in Sierra Leone, at the heart of where this outbreak has taken place, the US did have a biological warfare facility back in the 60s. I find it hard to believe that anybody would spread Ebola deliberately as a psychological warfare technique, because it's just too indiscriminate. But at the same time, it is very, very handy for the US military planners that they can now send thousands of paratroops to West Africa.
Hang on, paratroops or doctors?
No, the Cubans are sending doctors, the Americans are sending paratroops. Although what they're going to do to show, they're going to machine gun the Ebola, I suppose. But I mean, there is a lot of suspicion in Africa about US intentions and real interests. And, you know, the spread of jihadism from collapsed Libya and the creation of the Ebola epidemic give a perfect excuse for outside intervention in the region.
Well, before we hear from Len Horowitz, there's a couple of stories that come to mind. First of all, this is from the 21st of May this year. Experiments could cause deadly bird flu pandemic, scientists warn. Scientists have created a new and highly contagious form of bird flu that could trigger a deadly global pandemic if it is accidentally unleashed. This is scientists, research scientists, saying that actually these research programs are inherently dangerous. They're creating biological warfare agents, effectively. rapidly or biological, incredibly dangerous strains of diseases just by experimenting, that they shouldn't be doing it, scientists are saying.
Well, they've been experimenting to create biological weaponry for years and years and years for military reasons. So if you're going to do it for military reasons, you then say, ah, yes, but we also need to develop, antidotes and so on, and we can't develop antidotes unless we carry on working on these biological warfare strains. But, I mean, the whole thing is incredibly dangerous, well, as you say. If you're going to go around creating, deliberately creating, violently dangerous pathogens, it's bound to be a dangerous thing to do, isn't it?
Then there was another story, also in May this year. Barack Obama's top anti-terror advisor has pledged the CIA will no longer use their vaccination programs in order to cover up spying operations.
Well, so this is a reference to the so-called assassination of Osama bin Laden, where they gathered information about where he was in this compound by pretending to be vaccination workers.
So they're using basically vaccination workers as a cover for a massive spying operation.
Yes, which of course means that then of course people actually involved in vaccination programs in Afghanistan then get assassinated by the Taliban as spies. So it was a very, very bad thing for them to do. But also, of course, Seymour Hersh has pointed out the evidence that Osama bin Laden was assassinated in this attack is virtually non-existent to zero, which is why, of course, the body of whoever it was who was assassinated was disposed of at sea. No fingerprints, no photographs, nothing.
Okay,
in actual fact, it was basically a load of propaganda.
Okay, let's hear now from the author of Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident or Intentional, that is to say, Dr. Leonard Horowitz. And here he explains why he thinks very few people will actually believe that these kinds of viruses could be deliberately manufactured.
The concept that the United States government had something to do with the development of immune system ravaging viruses, AIDS virus, Ebola virus, that most people can't believe this. See, as a behavioral scientist, as a behavioral science expert, I knew most human beings who developed because of loving parents who instilled ethics and morals and values could not conceive of this level of evil, that they would never believe it. If you leave here today, I guarantee you, 9 out of 10 people that you speak and you tell them about this, you will see a window shade of disbelief come across their eyes, and you know you're no longer talking to a human being with ears. And so, knowing that ahead of time, as a behavioral science expert, I said, I got to reprint the most incriminating document so that it is totally there. It is no question. And so, this is one of numerous documents that you see reprinted in the book, Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola, where this is from the journal Nature, 1970, and you see Robert C. Gallo from the National Cancer Institute, you see Robert C. Ting from Bionetics Research Labs, Bethesda, Maryland. And it turned out that about a third of what Dr. Robert Gallo published, he published with Bionetics researchers. Have you ever heard of Litton Industries, folks? You know, Litton has Litton. A lot of people know him from their microwave ovens. But besides microwave ovens, they're a highly diversified company. They're heavily involved. Interestingly enough, they are among always the leading military weapons contractors for the world. And they have a medical subsidiary called Litton Bionetics, Bionetics Research Labs, a documented biological weapons contractor. And you see that Dr. Robert Gallo, about a third of 25% to 30% of what he published, co-authored with these people. Now here what they're studying, without getting too technical, is an enzyme called reverse transcriptase. It's actually, the technical name is RNA-dependent DNA polymerase of human acute leukemic cells. That is a unique enzyme called reverse transcriptase. It calls for life to operate in reverse, this enzyme does. And you see, in cells and tissues, what it calls for is that DNA is to be taken, and from DNA, this blueprint, new RNA is created, which then serves to bring and establish proteins, amino acids and proteins, to the protein manufacturing station of the cell called the ribosome. And it is here where proteins are built, new cell parts are built, and new cells, healthy, happy cells, evolve. DNA to RNA to new proteins to new cell parts to new life. This enzyme says, we're not going to have that anymore. We're going to go backwards. We're going to take a single strand of RNA that the virus is going to present. And because of the presence of this unique reverse transcriptase, a new DNA strand gets created. It's called a DNA provirus. And because of the presence of another very interesting enzyme, it's called an endonuclease. It's like a scissors. It cuts open, and it allows this new DNA strand to get inserted. So that now when the perfect cell begins to read this message for how to create new life, it gets fooled. It calls for the production of more viruses instead of healthy cell parts. And that these viruses butt off the cells. And because of these unique proteins on the outside membrane, they're called GP120-like proteins, like little balls here, you see? Through lock and key fashion, they seek out other cells, CD4 helper cells, T lymphocytes, the quarterbacks of the immune system. And they attach to these and they continue this process. Now, this is being done by Robert Gallo and his associates from Bionetics Research, and they're studying this in acute, human acute, that's quick-acting leukemia cells. This is in 1970, folks. This is 14 years before this man allegedly discovered the first AIDS virus. This is the enzyme that makes the AIDS virus tick. This is also the enzyme that makes the leukemia virus work. And this is 9 years before this man allegedly discovered the first leukemia virus, HTLV-1. And, as I said, his co-authors from Litton Bionetics just happened to be sixth on the list of major Army biological weapons contractors at that time. This is directly from the United States Congressional Record. What else were they doing and publishing? Well, they were the world's preeminent experts in monkey cancer virus research. And what they were doing in not only monkeys but primates, man as well, was they were taking these viruses that they knew would cause cancer. For example, they took woolly monkey viruses and rhesus monkey viruses, including this thing called SV40, simian virus 40. It was the 40th monkey virus ever discovered. This virus was discovered by Bernice Eddy. She found it late 50s, early 60s. She inoculated this vaccine containing SV40 into virtually every animal, and the animals started to die. She inoculated a dozen monkeys with these. All monkeys keeled over, paralyzed, or dead. She took photographs. She presented the photographs to the National Institute of Health director, who confiscated the photos and then proceeded to demote and defund this woman. It took her 10 years before she struggled in a crusade to get to Congress. And in front of Congress, she said to the congressman, 1972, she says, "If you continue to allow these contaminated vaccines to go out, I guarantee you over the next 20 years, you will have epidemics of cancer unlike the world has ever seen."
Well, pretty frightening stuff, Martin, but also all under the guise of US defense contracts with these companies, this company Litton Bionetics. And funnily enough, in the same exact place as we were talking about Rita Katz the other day, who released the beheading videos, Bethesda, Maryland.
Yes, that was quite a technical presentation, but I think the take-home I get from that is, let's face it, they are developing biological weapons which are designed to kill people, and it's quite easy to imagine that those could escape from the lab and become a threat to humanity. I mean, how stupid we are as human beings. We're paying people with our taxes to create things to kill us, and whether it's done by accident or design, it's potentially disastrous for us, isn't it?
Okay, a short clip now, another one from Leonard Horowitz, which is really where he actually discovers the original contract, 1962 Department of Defense contract with this company, Litton Bionetics, to develop these kinds of viruses.
Now, why can I stand before you so clear and so sure of what I'm telling you is the gospel? Well, because I found the contracts. In fact, what you're looking at here is the contract under which numerous AIDS-like and Ebola-like viruses were developed. This is Robert C. Gallo, project officer from the National Cancer Institute. Here's Robert Ting. See, John Landon was director of Bionetics Research Labs, National Institute of Health contract number 712025. It was entitled "The Investigation of Viral Carcinogenesis in Primates." That's cancer production through viral infection in monkeys and humans. And you look at the date that they started, those in the front can see, February 12, 1962. and you see how much they were paid was $2.153 million. That's what is on the contract summary report. $2.153 million.
Quite a lot of money in 1962. And one of the things that actually made me particularly interested in Len Horowitz's stuff is there's loads and loads of fake videos on YouTube which pretend to be him, which are actually sort of gobbledygook videos. There's been a big attempt, it seems, to discredit his work and also to make it difficult to find.
Yeah, well, if you can imagine that they are developing these viruses, which are anti-personnel viruses, they've been caught doing it, and they've also been caught potentially deliberately spreading these viruses around. Of course they'd want to cover their tracks. It's a bit like 9/11 we were mentioning earlier. That it wasn't just an inside job. There was then a whole propaganda campaign surrounding it. It wasn't, you know, the psychological warfare very much shapes the world we live in. And I'm afraid it's becoming even more apparent as time goes on.
Another story. Blighty, welcome, your new faceless MI6 chief. Got to cover this one, Martin. A new boss of MI6 has been appointed. The career spook Alex Younger has been named as the new head of MI6, replacing Sir John Sawyers before taking up his position as the boss of the Secret Intelligence Service. This is SIS, which is more widely known as MI6. Younger oversaw its global operations. After joining in 1991, he was posted to Europe and the Middle East before becoming the senior SIS officer in Afghanistan, one of the permanent government.
Well, yes, well, as I said earlier, Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister, is on French television as saying that the British approached him before the war in Syria, saying, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. I wonder if this chap knows anything about that, because if he does, then maybe it's time for the police to feel his colour.
We could only hope, apparently, that the new C is a bit more clandestine than his predecessor, whose wife famously blew his cover by publishing a number of family photos on Facebook. Younger said, I'm delighted and honoured to become chief of SIS and lead one of the best intelligence agencies in the world. What do these intelligence agencies actually do nowadays, and how accountable are they?
Well, they're not very accountable at all, and what they do is they don't tell us what they do. What they do is an awful lot about it. It's not gathering intelligence, it's actually pushing disinformation.
Are they working for our elected representatives, no, politicians, or are they just working for big corporations and trying to grab resources?
There is prima facie evidence that MI6 were involved in starting the war in Syria. Not Assad, MI6. Now, that means that we, the British people, in our name, have actually begun a civil war. And it may be that they know something about the shootings at the beginning, in the demonstrations that began the civil war, where people were shooting both police and demonstrators, as they did in Venezuela and as subsequently happened in Kiev. I'll bet you MI6 know an awful lot about that. The police should feel their collar.
OK, Martin, thanks very much. Time to sign off now. Murdoch News at 7 time, followed by Mohammed and his Arabian Nights. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Conservative MP for Bristol North West, Charlotte Leslie. Thanks also to HSBC whistleblower Nicholas Wilson and his website, nicholaswilson.com. You can follow all of our material, links and things on the internet at www.thisweek.org.uk and my own Twitter feed at Tony Gosling. See you next week, and don't let the banksters, particularly HSBC, get you down.
Live from the Sky News Centre.